verse 22 of Ezekiel 34. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. I will save my flock, and they will no longer be plundered. I will judge between one sheep and another. I will place over them one shepherd, my servant David. And he will tend them. He will tend them and be their shepherd. Well, are you looking forward to Christmas? It isn't far away now, is it? Even if you're not totally looking forward to it, and with all the rush and bustle of getting ready for it, I couldn't totally blame you if you said there was some misgiving in your hearts about this annual celebration. Even if you're not looking forward to Christmas, I guess you'd have to agree with me, wouldn't you, that it is important for us human beings to have something to look forward to. It's a very depressing scenario when you can say that the future horizon is utterly featureless and bleak. C.S. Lewis, in that famous children's story of his, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, describes such a situation rather well, doesn't he? A land, he says, of perpetual winter. One of the characters says, always winter and never Christmas. What could be more uninviting than such a place? No, we need to look forward to something. The future must hold out some better prospect than the past, or we are sucked by the enfeebling loss of hope into apathy and pessimism. 2.5 millennia ago, the Jews were close to just such despair. The winter of their discontent had taken a long while to arrive, mainly because their sense of national purpose had been so extraordinarily resilient and vigorous. The most distinctive feature about Israel in the Old Testament is the intensity of her belief in her own destiny. She was special. She was unique. She was the chosen people, the covenant people of God. She read about that in her Holy Scriptures. She celebrated it in her temple worship. And that meant whatever disasters might overtake her neighbors, she would be okay. There would always be some dramatic, supernatural reversal of fortune that would restore her prosperity. So she had believed. Believed it passionately, believed it tenaciously. And for many years, it had kept the chill wind of winter away. And that's why, when the cold wind did at last blow, it was so catastrophically devastating. Just look back at chapter 33, verse 21. It's a key verse in the book of Ezekiel, a kind of watershed in the book. In the 12th year of our exile, in the 10th month, on the 5th day, a man who had escaped from Jerusalem came to me and said, the city has fallen. She had never believed it could happen. It was unimaginable, but in the year 587 BC, the unthinkable did happen. After 2 years of siege, Jerusalem fell to the Babylonian army, and they razed it to the ground. They did not leave a stone on top of another. The beautiful temple that was its centerpiece was reduced to rubble. Jerusalem was the beloved capital city of the Jewish people. It was the symbol of all her hope. Those hopes had taken a battering in recent years, it's true. Her population had already been decimated by an earlier defeat at the hand of the Babylonians, and many, many taken into exile. Her economy was in tatters as a result of Babylonian plundering of her territory and taxation and tribute that she had demanded. But with this last and final blow, the tattered remnants of Jewish morale had finally snapped. The last thread of her national pride had broken. Not even a delusion of grandeur was now left to the Jewish people. She had run out of dreams. At least, I say run out. Ironically, there were just a handful of Jews who, even in this hour of crisis, even in the midst of this appalling humiliation, the destruction of Jerusalem, still managed to hang on to hope. I say it's ironic that these particular men did that, because up until this moment of time, they had been the loudest in their expectations of the worst. They were prophets, you see. They saw Israel's decline under the advance of Babylonian supremacy as a judgment of God upon her idolatry, and had never tired of explaining what was happening in those very terms. If you were here last week, you'll remember we studied a passage from one of those prophets, Jeremiah, well called the weeping prophet, because of his expectation of doom. Today we look at another from exactly the same period, Ezekiel. When that awful day of Jerusalem's fall occurred, these men were in very different personal circumstances. Jeremiah was living inside the city of Jerusalem itself. He had lived through those appalling days of siege. He was an eyewitness of the destruction of the city. Ezekiel, on the other hand, was living in Babylonia, because like many of the leading Jews, he had been part of that group who had been exiled to Babylonia in the wake of that earlier military defeat. So these two men were separated by many hundreds of miles. And as a result, neither of them seems to have been aware of the other's existence. They don't seem to refer to one another very much, if at all. It's perhaps a confirmation, then, of the authenticity of their prophetic inspiration, that independent though their ministries were, the message which God gave each of them, separated by these hundreds of miles, was remarkably similar. Up until that fateful day in 587, both were prophets of judgment. Quite the most ferocious prophets of judgment the whole Bible knows. But on that day, the day when the message arrived, the city has fallen, both are transformed into prophets of hope. Chapter 34 of Ezekiel is a classic example of that latter period in Ezekiel's ministry, just as Jeremiah 31, which we were looking at last week, is an example of it in his Jerusalem-based colleagues' ministry. Both of these men are released by Jerusalem's tragedy to proclaim that a new day is coming. For Jeremiah, it means a new covenant, remember? For Ezekiel, it means a new shepherd. Look back to the beginning of the chapter to see how he introduces that motif. The word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Woe to the shepherds of Israel who only take care of themselves. Should not shepherds take care of the flock? Verse 7, therefore, you shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. As surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, because my flock lacks a shepherd, and so has been plundered, and has become food for all the wild animals, and because my shepherds did not search for my flock, but cared for themselves rather than for my flock, therefore, O shepherds, hear the word of the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says. I am against the shepherds, and will hold them accountable for my flock. Now, the shepherds, of course, which Ezekiel's referring to here, are not literal herdsmen tending woolly herbivores. This is a parable. The word shepherd here is a metaphor for the leaders of the people, as we would say, the government of Israel. It's a very appropriate metaphor because, as we saw earlier in our service, David, the great king, who had in many ways modeled what monarchy was meant to mean in Israel, David himself had been a shepherd before he was lifted to royal office. Psalm 78, at the very end of that psalm, you'll find the psalmist celebrating that. He chose David his servant and took him from the sheep pens, from tending the sheep. He brought him to be the shepherd of his people Jacob. So David shepherded them, and with skillful hands he led them. So, you see, David's professional background as a herdsman was not totally an accident of history. The shepherd, in many respects, is God's ideal king, blending, as he does, authority with care, strength with compassion. By choosing this metaphor, then, Ezekiel both reminds us of the kind of monarchy that David had represented, the kind of monarchy for which the Israelite monarchy was supposed to stand, and also reminds us that when God looks for leadership, he looks for pastoral qualities, therefore. Unfortunately, though he had found such qualities in David himself, it seems they had become notable for their absence in his more recent successors. Woe to the shepherds of Israel who only take care of themselves. Should not shepherds take care of the flock? Notice the three charges that Ezekiel lays against the government of his day, the leaders of his people. First, he charges them with a lack of integrity, verse 3. You eat the curds, clothe yourselves with the wool, and slaughter the choice animals, but you do not take care of the flock. In other words, you feather your own nest at the nation's expense. You exploit the power that you have been given to your own advantage. The royal aristocracy live in luxury out of the oppression of the poor. As we might say, they milked the economy. They fleeced the country. A lack of integrity, then. More than that, Ezekiel accuses them of a lack of compassion, verse 4. You have not strengthened the weak, or healed the sick, or bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strays, or searched for the lost. You have ruled them harshly and brutally, so they were scattered. It's one of the hallmarks of Old Testament politics that God expects governments to show a particular concern for the weak and the vulnerable in their communities. Something you come across again and again and again, both in the law and in the prophets. Ezekiel makes a metaphor of that, a parable of that here, as he speaks of a shepherd looking after the feeble members of the flock. That's what a good shepherd is meant to do. But in Israel, it seems, it had become a case of survival of the fittest. The law of the jungle. Government had become merciless, autocratic, callous, he says. They didn't just lack integrity. They weren't just feathering their own nest. They lacked compassion. And thirdly, he accuses them in verses 5 and 6 of a lack of responsibility. So they were scattered because there was no real shepherd. And when they were scattered, they became food for all the wild animals. My sheep wandered over all the mountains on every high hill. They were scattered over the whole earth, and no one searched or looked for them. Notice that. Nobody cared. The shepherds who should have been caring couldn't be bothered about it. They displayed no remorse for the social disintegration that was a result of their self-indulgent policies. They were presiding over an ever more weakened and divided society, and they could not care less. As we might say, the country was going to the dogs, and the government didn't lift a finger. Ezekiel insists that the shepherds of Israel, the leadership, must take a large share of the blame, therefore, for the misery that had so recently befallen beloved Jerusalem. Their negligence had been a major cause for this collapse of hope into which the nation had been plunged. See how he goes on in verse 7? Because my flock lacks a shepherd, and so has been plundered. That's the reason it has been plundered, because the shepherds haven't done their job. It's become food for all the wild animals, because my shepherds did not search for my flock, but cared for themselves rather than for my flock. This is what the Lord says. I am against those shepherds. I will hold them accountable for my flock. Notice that word. Accountable. It raises an issue, of course, which has always interested political philosophers. In what respect are governments accountable? To whom is a government of a country accountable? Some governments behave as if they were accountable only to themselves. And that leads to totalitarianism. Some governments at least pretend to be accountable to the people. We call that democracy. But you'll notice here that Ezekiel doesn't really endorse either of those models. According to him, it's not a question of the sovereignty of the state or the sovereignty of the electorate. It's all a case of the sovereignty of God. These shepherds, he insists, are my shepherds. All governments are accountable to me. I'm the one who appoints these shepherds, and they will answer to me for the way they care for the flock. That, I suggest to you, is just as true of pagan and secular leadership as it was of the leaders of theocratic Israel. For we find very similar things being said by Daniel to Nebuchadnezzar, the emperor of Babylon, very similar things being said by Jesus to Pilate, very similar things being said by Paul about the Roman Empire, that the governments that exist are appointed by God and are accountable to him for the way they exercise his power. So when God looks at a government, he expects to see evidence of moral responsibility. He expects them to behave as shepherds under his tutelage. You notice he doesn't denounce the Israelite monarchy or the Israelite aristocracy here as an institution. It's not that Ezekiel is a Republican. He doesn't denounce them for a lack of parliamentary opposition. It's not that Ezekiel is a Democrat. He doesn't denounce them like a Marxist because they're capitalists, or like an anarchist because they are a government. He doesn't address their political complexion as such. His concern is with the way they used the power with which they had been charged. However they had obtained it, under whatever political system they wielded it, his accusation concerns how they used that power. Is there exploitation of the country? Is there corruption? Is there compassion towards the weak? Do they care? Is there evidence of moral responsibility for the situation? Do you sense that this is a government that knows it must give account to someone higher than itself? I put you there to be shepherds, he says. And the tragedy of Jerusalem is down to the fact that you have behaved instead like butchers. Don't you think there could be a lesson for us and our nation in that? I am quite sure the Conservative Party will be licking the wounds of the Dudley West by-election for some months yet. I'm quite sure people in that party at a very high level will be seeking explanations. How is it? But when the economy of the country really is beginning to turn the corner, nobody seems to credit them with the improvement. Well, I don't know how you feel about it, but my clear impression is that this country feels as though it is in a crisis of leadership. You see that everywhere. You see it in the attitudes to the royal family. You see it too in the church, of course. But you see it also, and perhaps most tellingly, in the government. Not just in John Major individually, but the government as a whole. People speak of a lack of integrity. The sleaze factor may have been widely exaggerated by the press, but it is there. And it shouldn't be. People speak of a lack of compassion. This government has the reputation of being a party that does not care. There is no doubt about that. Just talk to people on the streets, especially those homeless ones. It also has the reputation of being a government that lacks any clear sense of responsibility, that blunders in short-term responses and never seems willing to apologize, will not accept that there is social decay in our cities, and that in some respect at least, they must take responsibility for it. I'm sure John Major and others will be reflecting upon that humiliating defeat in Dudley West. It may be that as they do so, they do well to read Ezekiel 34 at the same time. You have not brought back the strays or searched for the lost. You have not strengthened the weak or healed the sick. You have ruled them harshly and brutally. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. I am against the shepherds and will hold them accountable for my flock. I will remove them from tending the flock so the shepherds can no longer feed themselves. I will rescue my flock from their mouths. But we better not be too complacent about pointing the finger at governments. For if Ezekiel 34 has relevance to a government in trouble, it has relevance too to a church in trouble. If Israel is a model nation, it is also a model of the covenant people of God. And what God speaks here of the shepherds, the leaders of Israel, is even more clearly directed at the leadership of the church in our land. And it is directed at the leaders of the government. You don't need me to tell you how much confusion there is reigning at present in the Church of England. There's a very important conference going to be held in early January, an evangelical conference, in which I'm sure important questions will be asked. Whether they will be answered or not is another matter. Why is it that the moral and spiritual grip of Christianity, and particularly the national church, upon Britain seems to be weakening, seems to be declining so very rapidly? How is it we're now in a position that we can contemplate that Britain will no longer identify with its Christian heritage any longer, publicly? Doesn't it have something to do with a crisis of leadership? Leadership in the heir to the throne, who it seems is no longer willing to be called a Christian. Leadership among the bishops, who have signally failed to exercise moral discipline, even among themselves. Leadership in the ecclesiastical bureaucracy, which it seems to many ordinary men and women in this country have more to do with high finance in the City of London than it does in caring for the parishes of these islands. Now, if the Church of England wants to know why it's in such dire straits, it needs to read Ezekiel 34. I am against the shepherds. Be shepherds of the flock, says the apostle, to those elders of the church in Ephesus. Be shepherds of the flock, which God bought with his own blood. If it is a privileged thing to lead a country, it is an even more privileged and even more responsible thing to lead a church. One of the church fathers says, if I had the very blood of Christ in a vessel, how carefully I would carry it. And he goes on to say, should I not then care just as carefully for the souls for whom that blood was shed? The preciousness of the church to Christ is measured by the wine on the table. It is the church he purchased with his own blood. And God will certainly be against the shepherds who treat such a precious flock with indifference. God is concerned with quality of leadership, you see. He's much less concerned about political ideology than many of us are. Much less concerned about whether our cross goes against the Conservative or the Labour or the Liberal Democrat. Much more concerned with how the leaders we appoint exercise their leadership in our country. Whether that's over the nation or over the church. He's concerned about quality in leadership. And that's why he says, Christmas ought to be a very happy time of year for us. Look at verse 11. This is what the Sovereign Lord says. I myself will search for my sheep and look after them. As a shepherd looks after his scattered flock when he is with them, so I will look after my sheep. I will rescue them. If Ezekiel had been writing this a few months even earlier, I think he would have stopped at verse 10. You wouldn't have the rest of Ezekiel 34. This isn't the first time, after all, that Ezekiel has complained about leadership in Israel. He's done it numerous occasions. But previously, every chapter in which that has been his theme has ended on a pessimistic note. A note of judgment. For before chapter 33, verse 21, before that message arrives, the city has fallen. His prophetic imagination doesn't seem to penetrate beyond the immediate darkness of that appalling winter that was about to befall his people. But now he begins to glimpse the first shoots of spring. Now a new expectation begins to dawn. All right, hope has failed. All right, the shepherds have failed. But all is not lost. For God says, if men cannot supply leadership for his world and for his people, he will come down and do the job himself. People were talking a few years ago about direct rule in Northern Ireland. Well, what we have here is a prophecy of direct rule from heaven. See what it will bring in its wake? Salvation, I will rescue my scattered flock. Restoration, I will bring them out from the nations and gather them from the countries. I will pasture them. I will tend them in good pasture. And justice, verse 16. I will search for the lost and bring back the strays. I will bind up the injured and strengthen the weak. The sleek and the strong I will destroy. But as for you, my flock, this is what the Sovereign Lord says, I will judge between one sheep and another, between the rams and the goats. Salvation and restoration and justice and security. Look at verse 25. I will make a covenant of peace with them. So God promises to come and create a new world. A new world marked by security and justice and harmony and salvation. And this time he insists that happy state will never be forfeited. Why? Because he will supply the shepherd. Verse 22, I will save my flock They will no longer be plundered, and I will place over them one shepherd, my servant David. He will tend them and be their shepherd. Are you feeling a bit depressed this winter? Depressed perhaps with our world generally, with Bosnia and Rwanda and, as usual, countless other places that make the heart bleed. Disillusioned with this country, maybe. Fed up with the government, as clearly many people in Dudley West are fed up with it. Mourning the loss of moral leadership from which we seem to be suffering. Fed up with the church. Disappointed by the failure of church leaders to really model holiness and commitment to truth. Disillusioned perhaps even with life itself. Feeling some emptiness inside because your future horizon seems so bleak. Always winter. No. Christmas is coming. Indeed, Christmas has come. What was it Luke records in those early days of the gospel story? There were shepherds in the fields, keeping watch over their flocks by night. And suddenly a great company of the heavenly host appeared. Today in the town of David, a Savior has been born to you. He is Christ, the Lord, they said. I am the good shepherd, he would tell them when he grew up. All that ever came before me and pretended to be leaders of God's flock were just robbers, exploiters. Ezekiel was right. I am the good shepherd. I bring salvation. I bring blessing. I bring justice. I bring security. See, those words of Ezekiel 34 were not just written for the Jews. They were written for us. They are a messianic prophecy. Ezekiel is looking forward to the coming of the Christ, the Son of David, who once again would establish the kind of rule God wants. The winter of our discontent will be made glorious summer by the coming of that Son of David. And he's here, you see. That's why Christmas is so wonderful. Oh, I know his kingdom has not yet fully claimed the world, but it will do. And he himself has already come. He reigns now. He can reign in our lives, in our hearts. He can bring significance and hope to those of us who are feeling disillusioned with earthly shepherds. I am the good shepherd, he says. We don't need to surrender to secular pessimism. We don't need to languish in despair that the world is going to the dogs, that the country is going to the dogs, that the church is going to the dogs, that my life is going to the dogs. We don't have to wallow at the end of 1994 in such wintry and bleak pessimistic thoughts. Christmas is coming. A new day is coming. And we Christians, like Ezekiel, even though Jerusalem be falling into ruin about our ears, we Christians believe in Christmas. Let's pray together.